everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one in the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their fabulous summer yearly writers conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, as I just said in my little intro, Author to Author is about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two, in my opinion, are one and the same. And for me, one way that our books and our lives are very similar is that our lives, or life itself, for humans, I believe, is just a story we are telling ourselves. And I think today's guest, the fabulous novelist Keith Donahue, would perhaps agree with me. His third novel, Centuries of June, was in many ways a story about stories. But I don't want to put words into his mouth. He's a writer. He can choose his own words. So let's get him on the show and see if he agrees with me. Keith, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure.
You might have
heard my little spiel there.
I did.
Just before I let you on. Life is a story we are telling ourselves. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm trying to figure out where the next chapter is going, almost as we're living this current one.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I think you're right. You're absolutely right about, life is the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. And we're all the hero of our own little novel. And as I say, we're trying to figure out where it's going.
Yeah, we don't get to know. We don't get to know, but we do. We are kind of, I always think that, you wake up, I write in the morning every day. It's the first thing I do. And I always feel like I wake up and I face like the blank page of the whole day. I might have a little plan, I always do, but really the plan will change, just like I have a plan for a chapter, say, but of course, I don't know if you're like that, but it always changes once I get into it.
Oh, absolutely. The great thing about writing and getting lost in the story that you're working on are those little surprises. That you don't expect, you don't anticipate, and take the story in a different direction. The book I'm working on now, suddenly Dr. Seuss appears in it.
Wow.
I don't know how that ever happened, but there he comes.
Wow, that's great. I mentioned Centuries of June, which was your third novel, was kind of a... It's not a word a writer you're allowed to use, but I'll use it for you. It was kind of a tour de force, really. There were like 8 characters, 9? How many different little stories were there linking the one story all together?
Well, there are 8 women from 5 centuries, Then there's the narrator's story, which we get to hear in the first person. And then there's a mysterious older man who shows up in the bathroom early on. So I'm going to say at least 10.
Yeah, so there's a lot of stories, and really when I read it, I was reading it, of course, as just a reader, but also as a writer, and I was observing, because as you mentioned, there's 8 women from 5 centuries, and each new woman will tell her tale in a different voice, but not just a different voice, but you're having to, as a writer, you are having to render that place and time, and I know what it takes to render a place and time that isn't, you live in Washington, D.C., do you not?
Yeah, near Washington, yeah.
Yeah, so that isn't right there. You have to go learn about it. And each one, I thought, was very fully realized.
Okay.
And I thought, my goodness, what an ambitious undertaking. And I think when we talked about it, you said you wanted something challenging for yourself. Was that true? You wanted the challenge. You put it before yourself.
Right. I did want the challenge. I'm sure that you'd agree with us about challenges, right? That it's part of the great fun of writing. The great, there's a modicum, I would have to say, of research involved. But there's also, you know, the sheer act of will to say, okay, well, I'm going to write about the 16th century. I don't live in the 16th century, so I've got to make all that up.
Yeah.
And live within the different frameworks that you set up for yourself.
I always think one of the most challenging things about writing, challenging aspects to writing about another time and place so far removed, which the 16th century feels very far removed to me.
Right.
People are still the same, but so much about fictional narrative writing is the detail of life, and the detail, well, just the detail, and getting that detail is so much. I remember I was interviewing Alice Hoffman, and her book, and when I interviewed her for the collection of short stories she had written, she was working on a book about a woman during the time of Jesus, you know, in Rome, I think.
Yeah.
She was. And she said it was just so hard to find details about the everyday life of a woman at that time, because that's what so much of fiction is made up of, at least in terms of the flow of detail along.
Right, but when you do find something, you seize on it, and you say, oh, I can use that.
Yeah.
One of the sort of writerly tricks, if you will, of Centuries of June is that each of the stories over these five centuries is done in a style that reflects that particular century. So, for example, there's a chapter on the Salem witch trials, and a lot of it's composed of archival materials and letters and case files and so forth that really exist. But, of course, I was making up a new story, so I had to change the details there of each of the case files. But the case files themselves are enough, I think, to give that verisimilitude that you're looking for.
But I always take a pleasure in, I guess maybe it's the kind of the parrot in me, but if I find myself reading a lot of a certain kind of material, like, say, case files from Salem Witch Trial, it then goes into me, and a part of me is dying to write in that voice that has been in me, and then to like an actor who's been listening to British accents for a long time, having to speak in it, I find myself compelled to want to write in that voice that's been going into me and into me and into me, but in my own way. Did you go through that?
Yeah, that's, as I say, you're right on the same wavelength about how much fun that actually is.
Yeah.
You know, that you can play with it and you know, move it around and vamp and riff and all that stuff, where, you know, and in centuries of having all these eight different stories, I got to try on eight different dresses. I mean, I got to try on, you know, these wonderful women.
Yeah. And, you know, and Centuries of June was also a bit of a ghost story, really.
Right.
Obviously, pretty much everybody's, like, I don't want to give it away, but obviously a lot of the women who were living 800 years ago or 500 years ago have, you know, are back telling their stories. So
right.
There's a ghost story element to it. And not to get too personal, but what are your own feelings about the idea of ghosts and sort of the world beyond the physical?
Well, I have to confess, I've never seen a ghost.
Okay.
So let's get that out of the way right first off. And I've never seen another, what you might call a supernatural creature,
right.
Which is some of my other books have been about, things that we don't often see. And so to me, the question of like whether these things exist or not, it's not very important to me that whether there are ghosts or not.
Right.
For the way the story is constructed, there had to be ghosts.
Right.
In order for the thing itself to work, in order for the idea itself to work, you have to say, okay, well, at least for now, I believe in ghosts.
Right.
So while I was writing it, and if I read it again, I probably would say, okay, well, I'll buy into this guy's premise.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One time I was listening, I can't remember what I was watching, something, and there was a medium on, and they were doing this thing, you know. And I thought, and he was going through the interpretation, you know, he was trying to flesh out what he was talking to or whatever. And I thought, God, he sounds like me when I'm fleshing out a story. I don't mean to impugn him, but in other words, the information, when I'm writing a story, even a very small one, the information comes to me in such odd bits and pieces, and I'm kind of listening to it, and then bit by bit it comes into full focus, but it starts very far away and distant, and it almost and he reminded me of that, and he reminded me, this one medium, of a writer creating. I don't mean to say he was lying. I don't know what he was doing, but
no,
the relationship to the imagination feels very close to what he was doing.
Right, and I think that there's a show on Animal Planet called The Hunt for Bigfoot or The Search for Bigfoot or something like that, and there's these guys go out and, you know, with night cameras and infrared, and they're looking for Bigfoot, and you got to think, well, part of them might be skeptical because they've not really ever found Bigfoot, but part of them, it seems to me that they actually do believe that something is out there, and if that helps them create their story, that's fine. I got no problem with it. I don't, you know, and in a way, it's kind of inconsequential whether Bigfoot actually exists or not.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, it's a myth that we tell ourselves. It's these ghost stories are stories we tell ourselves to explain our lives right now.
Yeah.
Now,
to shift gears slightly, I know that before you had a PhD in English. Did you teach English at the college level, whatever?
I never did. I got it late in life. That was my idea, was to go back into teaching. I was working in the government, and on the theory that this would free up some time to write.
Right.
But I had three kids and, you know, so on and so forth. It wasn't going to happen.
But you went into speech writing eventually.
Yeah, that's right.
That's an interesting beginning for a novelist, in a way, because you had to, I mean, you kind of had to, I mean, and you were writing speeches, and you had to kind of assume their voice, in a way, didn't you? The person for whom you were writing?
Yeah, you do. You do have to listen to their speech patterns, their habits, their ways of thinking, and try to mimic that as best you can, at the same time conveying the information in the speech that needs to be conveyed, and that's a kind of a tricky game, but a lot of that comes through the process of meeting with the principal and, you know, doing a draft and getting a draft back and saying, oh, well, they like to do this or they don't like to say that or whatever. It's more like an editorial process.
Right. And then there is the experience of hearing your words spoken aloud. Would you ever listen to the speeches once when he was delivering them? Was it a he you were writing for?
I wrote for two people, both they were chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. One was a man and one was a woman.
Okay. And did you listen, did you actually hear them when they were delivering the speeches?
Occasionally I would go.
You wouldn't?
I would go occasionally. I couldn't do everything because they traveled a lot and,
right,
you know, I wasn't part of an entourage or anything like that.
No, I understand. But
local thing, yeah, I would go and listen. And one time, you know, we worked really hard on whatever this speech was at the National Press Club or something like that. And I get there with, you know, several hundred other people, a few of them of whom know that I was her speechwriter, and at the last minute she decided to chuck it all and speak off cuff.
No way.
Yeah, no. So I was like, okay, well.
But I would
them's
still
breaks.
I would think the experience of, you know how it is, I mean, do you ever read your own, like when you're doing your, writing your fiction, do you ever read it aloud to yourself to hear it, or do you not need that?
No, I need that. I need it sentence by sentence, yeah.
Yeah, so you read it aloud.
I don't exclaim it like an actor or anything like that.
Oh, come on, Keith.
Nowadays with people who have their Bluetooth in all the time, and
yeah.
In the old days you would think they were, you know.
I know.
Talking to themselves.
I know. I was in the restroom once, and I heard somebody talking about what's going on. I thought, oh, I see.
Exactly.
He's on the phone. But you do read aloud. I think it's very helpful because when you read your work aloud, it's a strange thing that happens, but you don't know truly what you have until you hear it sometimes.
Oh, well, I think you're right. A lot of it is in the sound, and a lot of it is in the sentence. And, you know, a sentence can do all kinds of crazy things that, you know, you think you start a sentence and you think you know where it's going, and it takes another turn. And how do I get back?
I know. It's a very strange thing. You would think of something as short as a sentence, even a pretty good-sized one, you could have a – but no, it can go in a different direction. I was just having a discussion – be interested to hear what you have to say about this. I was having a discussion with my youngest son just this afternoon about perfectionism. He's 14, just turned 14, and he finds himself stymied because he's afraid to create stuff, and he's got tons of things in his head because he feels they won't be perfect, that he can see them in his head, but he can't make them real in whatever he wants to do, whether it's some music or a story or drawing or whatever. And I was trying to explain to him that one of the things about being a creative person is learning what happens when it moves from inside you to outside of you, how it's going to change no matter what. I'm sure you've had that experience.
Yeah, I would tell him, you know, welcome to the club, son. And, you know, and that's what, exactly what you're saying. That's what it's all about, is that we think we have this perfectly crafted thing in our mind's eye or our mind's ear or whatever. And getting it on paper and then getting somebody else to see it the way you saw it, that's a separate matter entirely. And it's the challenge. It's the challenge of the thing is to keep at it and keep you know, this sort of persistent approach, sentence by sentence or note by note, to get it as close as you can get it to what you would imagine.
And also, I spent a long time about 5 years ago writing a lot of music, and I really wanted to teach myself to write symphonic music, and I had a computer that could play the music back for me. And I was self-taught, so of course I was figuring it out as I went. And a lot of times, and I find this with writing too, I would have this one idea for this thing I wanted to hear. I'd write these things down thinking that's what it would be, and then I'd play it. It wouldn't be what I wanted, or I'd thought I wanted, but I liked what I got anyway, so I'd use it just the same. And I certainly have found that with writing, where I have an idea, and I wonder if you go through this too, where you've got this idea in your head, and then you write it. It doesn't come out that way, but you say, but you know, this is pretty good too, so let's roll with that.
Right. Right, and another aspect of it is about sort of your ambition. Right. When I was doing Century, before I did Centuries of June, I had this whole sort of thing worked out in order to keep the eight women separate.
Right.
I had them lined up by color and, you know, genre, and then things like this one is going to represent X and this one will represent Y. And it just it was too complicated. It was too complex. And as I pushed through it, I realized I don't need to do as much as I thought originally to get where I want to go.
It is fascinating to me how, no matter how good an idea you think you have, there is something about putting it on the page where you find out what you've actually got. And you just can't even – because no matter what you picture, for instance, no matter what you picture in your head, no matter how clearly you see a scene, you might see it all out. You know, you might see it almost like a cinematographer has, you know, shot it. Mm-hmm. You haven't put every single word down. And until you put every word down, that's when you know what you've actually got. Because there's always some gap that your imagination can't fill in until you put it down.
Right. You're absolutely right. And then, you know, as I said before, on the other side of it is the reader. And they bring all their, you know, baggage and so forth to the experience, and they read a different book than what you wrote. It's inevitable. It's part of how we interact as humans. I can tell you story after story, and they'll mean something to me, but it's going to be slightly different what it means to you.
Did you have that experience when you published your debut novel, Angels of Destruction? So you'd had an experience writing because you'd been writing doing speech writing, but this was your first big creative endeavor that was out there in the world. And a lot of the novelists I talk to who have the experience of publishing their first novel are somewhat surprised and almost alarmed to find that all these strangers are running out and buying it and reading it and drawing their own conclusions about it. That,
right,
in a way, that hadn't even entered into the equation until it actually happened. Did you go
right
through that at all, the sort of disorientation of
my first book was
taking an interest in this little thing you did?
Right. My first book was The Stolen Child.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay.
I mean, it did very well and so forth and so on, and you know, people reviewing it online and talking about it, and you're right. You just think, well, wait a minute. Why don't you like it?
You
know?
Right.
And if you don't like it, why did you keep reading? And
right,
why do you feel that, you know, I mean, I'm as sensitive to that as anybody.
Sure.
It's more the people who tell you they don't like it. Versus the people, and there were lots of people who said, "Oh, I love your book," and you know, and that you sort of learn to, you know, accept that graciously, but the criticism is like, "Oh my goodness."
Do you read reviews of your stuff?
I tend to read everything, you know, I tend to read everything, and for good or ill.
What do you do with that information? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, it's so you sort of think about it a little bit when somebody's right about, you know, what you may have done and you could have done better. And you think, okay, well, next time I'll be better. I'll just do this better.
Right.
And, you know, the weird thing for me was the size of audience. First book was a big, you know, had a big audience, and the next two books had much smaller audiences, and you just think, well, where is everybody?
Right.
You know,
where
did they go?
Right.
But, you know, I think that's, again, just part of the culture, part of, you know, who's the next hot young thing, and, you know, on the scene, and it's tough. But, you know, that's part of it. I mean, that's part of the whole equation. It still boils down to that act that you described earlier of waking up in the morning and having that blank page in front of you and filling it with your story. And that, to me, is where the true compelling reason to keep doing it exists. You know, it's not in the reviews and it's not in the sales, and it's really in the creative act.
Yeah, my sister, very smart woman, loved calculus, and she loved dissecting sentences, and she loved French because she could just translate everything exactly. And she's very bright that way, great at Scrabble and Boggle and so on, and got straight A's in college, but she got one B, which was in creative writing, as it turns out. And I was very surprised she ever took a creative writing class. And she said, "Oh, I hated that class." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because there's no right answers."
Yeah, that's right.
And I think, boy, if that isn't it, if that isn't what every writer stares down every... Because to some degree, in the West, the rational West, whether we're rational or not, but where that reason and rationality is held up in high esteem, right answers are cherished, you know,
yes,
sort of in society at large. But in the creative world, that doesn't exist, really. It's in you.
Right,
you never get to know.
It's sort of that the other half of that equation is, you know, there may not be right answers, but there are right questions.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know,
so what's a right question?
Well, I think it's what leads you to what can lead you to your story.
Yeah.
You know, that it's sort of, is this idea compelling enough to spend the time necessary to, you know,
create 100,000 words or 10,000 or whatever it turns out to be.
How long do you have to, you know, Roald Dahl talked about, the great children's book writer talked about, that he would sniff around an idea for a time before he would launch into it, because he figured he'd have to be, you know, he's going to be asking at least a year of his life to write one of these things. And so do you do that? Do you give yourself a certain amount of time when a first idea bubbles up in its little, you know, beginning forms? Do you give yourself some time to sniff around it for a while? Or do you dive in?
I think I need some time. I think I need a little bit of time to sort of figure out. For me, it's how am I going to structure this? How am I going to structure this and build it? That is the sticking point for, rather than the idea itself.
I see. And so do you have, so when an idea comes to you, you begin to try and sort of see it in its big form and start thinking about the structure before you even sit down to write any of it?
Yeah, like, you know, this, well, the book I'm working on now has four different voices. Four different characters, third-person characters, that I'm telling the story through. I didn't know that until I started.
Oh, okay.
You know, I figured out who the characters were and what the conflict was and then how best to tell it.
I see. But you didn't know until you started writing it that you were going to have four voices.
No.
No. And do you outline?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I didn't think so. I didn't think so. But you have? Do you have a kind of a loose sketch in your head?
I do have a loose sketch. I have a, you know, I know what the structure is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Centuries of Dune, I knew, you know, it was going to alternate between that first-person narrator and then the eight women. So, you know, that gives you, if you do every other chapter, that gives you a certain number of chapters. I could count them, but it gives you a certain number of chapters. So you know, okay, well, if a novel is 100,000 words, give or take, and I've got 16 chapters, then each chapter should be, I mean, I'm not mathematically precise here.
Right.
But something like that. Okay, well, these can be shorter and these can be longer and different things like that, which helps me because I try to squeeze in writing, you know, when I can.
Stuff? Oh, yeah. Do you have a schedule that you like to do it on?
No, I have one that I'd like to do it on, but
then
one I can do it on.
Oh, that can be tough. Are you able to do it 5 days a week?
I can do it 7 days a week if I get the time.
Right.
Like today, I've had this little flu or cold or whatever, and you know I found it really tough to write anything today.
Yeah. Writing when you're sick, although sometimes when I'm sick, it seems to go away for the writing and then come back.
Yeah.
It gives me a little respite just while I write, but it returns quickly.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Keith, thank you so much. This was just great. Good luck with the next book. It sounds interesting already. I'm curious to see if Dr. Seuss stays in it.
Okay. Thanks, Bill.
And again, good luck. And that's Centuries of June, everyone. It's a fabulous book. Pick it up. I highly recommend it. And thanks for stopping by. As always, next week, I believe, if all things go well, my guest will be John Connolly, the creepy suspense writer. Until then, do what you love, write what you love, and you really cannot go wrong at all.